Yes, so it's not going to be like this is a really sort of well planned out, thought, exhaustive talk about Exopia. Because I wanted to introduce him to you, and I also wanted to maybe try and create a bit of a context for devotional practice and the sort of like the title of this evening is Exopia in the Language of the Depths. Yeah. So, Exopia, as I mentioned, is this blue Buddha of the East, the in a way an archetype of wisdom, an embodiment of wisdom. And there's so much imagery, symbolism associated with him that we're going to be unpacking, and I'm going to be talking a bit about to just give you a sense of what he's about. And the phrase, the language of the depths, it comes from Sangharakshita, who's the teacher and founder of the Triratna Buddhist community. And I'm going to actually read what he says about the language of the depths in a minute. But basically, it's a lot about how, if we're going to engage with the spiritual life, we're going to make progress, if we're going to stay, continue, transform ourselves, we need to bring all of ourselves into our practice. Not just our thinking, rational mind. You know, there's all parts of ourselves that are completely irrational, you know, and emotional and unconscious. And all of that needs to be, all that energy, all that part of ourselves needs to also come along with us. Otherwise it just gets in the way and stops us. We need to actually find a way of working with, transforming, including every aspect of ourselves in our practice. And also because in spiritual practice there is something that is very mysterious. You know, if you've been meditating for any length of time, there have probably been experiences you have in meditation you can't quite conceptualise, can't put in words. You know they've been quite important, they've been quite significant. Maybe you can't quite understand why, but you do know that. Yeah. And there's whole kinds of things that you don't even want to try and put into words, you know, but you just have that experience. So there is something quite mystical, quite magical about certain aspects of practice, yeah, that go beyond concepts, that go beyond words. And there are certain truths that go beyond concepts, that go beyond words and go beyond the literal. Yeah. So there's a part of me that likes to be very analytic and likes to sort of make connections and do a bit of research and history and all that kind of stuff and put things in context, see how they link up, try and understand things. And I think that's really helpful. You know, you're trying to understand the world, trying to understand yourself, trying to understand teachings and all that kind of stuff. It does often require a bit of thinking. Yeah? But there's another way that we can engage with truth, which is on a sort of kind of more universal level, where something may not be literally true but is true. So that's the kind of truth that you often get, you know, with a great writer, you know, a play, a poem, somebody who dances a piece of a beautifully formed piece of pottery. Sometimes it can like communicate something, you know, that you resonates much deeply on a sort of truthful level, or maybe somebody's just captured something that is really true. It might not be beautiful, but it's something true. You know? So I think that's because it's resonating on a much more symbolic, archetypal level, a different kind of language, if you like to say it. In one of my incarnations, I was a nursery teacher, and in those days it was encouraged to tell kids lots and lots of stories and get them to engage with them and play with them and let them out and do all kinds of stuff with them. And, you know, there's loads and loads of picture books out there, and actually there's some fantastic picture books out there. And there's also ones that you know have been written because people think they will sell, or that it's got a good message, or that parents will like them, or schools will like them because of the message. And there's others that are a bit more subversive but just kind of work. But what I really was struck by is how, like fairy tales, the kids would respond to them in such a different level. You know, the classic ones, Goldilocks and the Three Bears, Three Little Pigs, Little Red Riding Hood. Because they do have layers and layers of meaning, they do kind of reverberate on different levels. And even, you know, 3- and 4-year-olds were picking that up, actually. So there's a part of us that does actually engage on that level. We can get manipulated around that with sort of like advertising and things like that, because they know that actually half the time we don't make decisions because we've thought them through. We do it much more on a sort of emotional level. And I myself am a sucker for packaging and things that look nice. But yes, so with the spiritual life, again, we also need to bring in that element. So having said that, I'm just going to read what Sangharakshita says about the language of the depths, because I think it kind of is quite clear about all of that. If we look below the rational, conceptual surface of man's mind, we find vast, unplumbed depths which make up what we call the unconscious. The psyche in its wholeness consists of both the conscious and the unconscious. And the unconscious, non-rational part of man is by far the larger part of his total nature, and its importance is far greater than we generally care to recognise. Consciousness is like a light froth playing and sparkling on the surface, whilst the unconscious is like the vast ocean depths, dark and unfathomed, lying far beneath. And actually, I'm going to say a bit more, but just that image, you get that in all kinds of spiritual traditions, the image of the ocean, or of, you know, like in the tarot, there's the high priestess with the water behind her, something about the depths, unfathomable, dark, but wisdom coming from that, intuition coming from that, that's different from our thinking mind. So, the vast ocean depths, dark, unfathomed, lying far beneath. In order to appeal to the whole person, it isn't enough to appeal just to the conscious, rational intelligence that floats upon the surface. Yeah? And so often we operate in life trying to do that, you know, act from our conscious, rational intelligence, yeah, that is much more surface. We have to appeal to something more, and this means that we have to speak an entirely different language from the language of concepts of abstract thought. We have to speak the language of images, of concrete form. If we want to reach this non-rational part of the human psyche, we have to use the language of poetry, of myth, of legend. This other, no less important language is one which many modern people have forgotten, or which they know only in a few distorted and broken forms. But Buddhism does very definitely speak this language, and speaks it no less powerfully than it speaks the language of concepts. Some people are under the impression that Buddhism speaks only the language of concepts, of reason, that it is a strictly rational system, even a sort of rationalism. And this is often a misunderstanding in the West, where a lot of our knowledge is derived from books, magazines and lectures. And although we may not always be aware of this, our approach is in terms of rational, conceptual understanding. If we go to the East, we often see a very different picture, where people are moved, influenced by the images all about them, without easily being able to give a rational, conceptual formulation of what they actually believe. So far as Buddhism in the West is concerned, more attention has been given to the conceptual, analytical, intellectual approach, and we now have to give much more time to the other approach and begin to combine the two, unite both the conceptual and the non-conceptual. We need a balanced spiritual life in which both the conscious and unconscious mind play their part. It is therefore through the language of poetry and myth that we need to approach Buddhism, changing over from the conceptual approach to the non-conceptual, from the conscious to the unconscious. And here we can encounter archetypal symbolism. And then we have to be receptive to open ourselves to these archetypal symbols to listen to them, allow them to speak in their own way to us, especially to our unconscious depths, so that we do not just realize them mentally, but experience them, assimilate them, allowing them eventually to transform our whole life. So there's something about receptivity that I think is quite important to practice, and especially to devotional practice, where you're allowing yourself to be open to responses. So responses to the Buddha, to the teachings, to the qualities of enlightenment that are communicated through the teachings, through an image, through a mantra. Yeah. So when we do mantra chanting, for instance, that's symbolic language, using sound as symbol, you know, and the mantra that we chant becomes an embodiment of a particular enlightenment quality or a way of connecting with a particular figure. When we see, you know, when we see a Buddha on the shrine, and particularly if they're one that we practice with a lot, on one hand, yeah, it's a statue that somebody has carved, you know. It's not the literal, actual Buddha. But when you sit, when you allow that to be a representative of the Buddha, there's a certain way that you can actually emotionally connect with the image. There's a certain way that you can... it becomes the Buddha. Yeah? On the one hand, it isn't the Buddha. On the other hand, it is the Buddha. You know? Because in our imagination, in our psyche, we can do that. Yeah. You could... this is me just playing with an idea, but in some ways it's a bit like there's lots of different ways that you can access the internet. There's this whole electronic world out there. You could see that there's a sort of another level, spiritual level, different level of consciousness, whatever, that we can access in different ways, maybe through meditation, maybe through an image, maybe through chanting, maybe through all kinds of other things. And I suppose that's one of the ways that these figures can have a lot of power. So I'm not sure if any of this is making sense. Is it making sense to people? Yeah, okay. Okay. So, I was somebody that used to be very, very sceptical of anything religious, certainly anything that wasn't rational. And I would come and I'd see people doing rituals and I would completely freak out. And I would, you know, have a bit of aversion, especially to some of the sort of Tibetan figures and imagery that didn't kind of make sense to me. And I mentioned this a bit on Sunday about how being on a retreat somewhere when I had been very much not engaging, not joining in with any of the rituals, and it was at this retreat centre where they had a very beautiful painting of this archetypal figure, White Tara, and I just, because I didn't want to join in the ritual, I'd just been looking at her and the image had an effect on me, you know, just looking at the beauty of it without knowing anything about who White Tara was, without knowing anything about what she symbolises, what she's about. In a way, I almost like fell in love with the image, you know. And there was one evening when everybody was there and I was doing my habitual not going in and being a bit grumpy and why are they doing all of this. And it was almost like she came to me and she sort of spoke to me and like, well, what are you doing, you know? Why are you being like this? Why don't you just, you know, get over yourself and, you know. And that was a time when I sort of, in a way, surrendered some of my barriers that I got with my conscious mind and let myself sort of join in, not really knowing what I was doing. And it had an effect. Actually, there's something about collective practice if you've joined in with one of our rituals or pujas. Even if you don't understand what it's about, even if you don't understand all the symbolism or why we're doing it, sometimes it'll have an effect. You know, there's a... and chanting mantras and things can have an effect. Once you do understand what the symbolism is, then it has a deeper effect, I think. And I think part of my practice is getting more and more open, receptive, having more and more connection with some of these figures and being more and more affected by them. So I've had a kind of love affair for many, many years with a lot of, well, basically the five archetypal Buddhas. There are all these enlightened beings, bodhisattvas, but there's in particular this mandala of five Buddhas. And you've got a Buddha in the east, the dark blue Buddha. You've got the Buddha of the south, yellow Buddha. You've got the Buddha of the west, the red Buddha. Buddha of the north, the dark green Buddha. And in the middle, you've got the white Buddha, Vairochana. And they each, you could say they are each the Buddha, and they are each embodiments, imaginative embodiments of enlightenment and qualities of enlightenment and qualities of the path. Yeah. And in a way, they each highlight particular aspects of the path, particular ways of approaching practice, particular in a way the Dharma can be so big, all the teaching can be so big, but you can sort of like, you know, have all the lists where you look at a particular thing, but if lists don't particularly engage your imagination or engage your heart, then I think exploring some of these figures or exploring one of these figures that can. So for me, there's always been like a heart response, and I've not necessarily known what the figure's about, and then later on I do a bit of the more rational reading up about them, what are the things about them, what they symbolise, what the history is, and then I have a bit more understanding about, yeah, actually what it is that unconsciously seemed to draw me to that figure. And then I kind of let go of that rational bit again, and then I just think about all the different imagery and symbolism around them, and sometimes one aspect will draw me, sometimes another aspect will draw me. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about Akshobhya and his qualities and some of the symbolism, just to sort of give you an overall picture of who he is and how that might work, and also maybe how that might work in terms of a personal response in practice, just giving my own experience. And then over the subsequent weeks, we'll be sort of going a bit more deeply into the different aspects and different symbolism associated with Akshobhya. So, first thing about him, this is dark blue. Colours do have an effect, don't they? There is some, you know, there is a real symbolism, a real effect of colour. You know, just a different shade of colour or whatever affects our mood or evokes something. Yeah. So I had this image. I was doing a guided visualization in a completely different context. I had this image of dark blue Buddha. Didn't even know there was a dark blue Buddha. Didn't even know there was a mandala of archetypal Buddhas. But I just had this image of a dark blue Buddha. And then people told me, oh, there is this dark blue Buddha called Akshobhya and you should read up about him. So I did. And a lot of his qualities were exactly what I needed to deal with my life and what I was struggling with in those days, you know, trying to work with. Yeah. So, yes, he's dark blue. And his name, Akshobhya, means unshakable. And there is a real quality of sort of being really firm, being really steady and unshakable and imperturbable. A lot of equanimity that I really love about Akshobhya. Yeah. Something about, there's a lot of kindness there, there's a lot of awareness there. But he, you know, he doesn't get shaken. That in fact the name comes more from the fact that he had he was unshakable in a vow that he made before he became a Buddha, which was that, you know, while he was practicing and trying to become a Buddha, being a bodhisattva, he wasn't going to experience ill will towards any living being. You know, and again, in the language, you know, we're told it's eons and kalpas, which is much more than eons, years and years, lifetime after lifetime, reborn, and he never experienced any ill will towards any living being. And therefore, when he did become the Buddha, they did give him that name, Unshakable, because he was unshakable in that vow. So there's something also there about continuity of purpose, you know, that you have an intention and you follow through on it, and taking a vow seriously, that you have an intention, you actually make a vow, and then rather than think, oh, I'd quite like to do that, but you don't, you know. And there are a few times when I've made vows, and actually it does have an impact, you know, it does feel a lot more serious than just something that I think, oh, I'd like to do, or talk with a friend about, oh, maybe I think I don't do that. But if you actually make a vow, it's sort of something quite serious. And I mean, I couldn't kind of get my head around all that fact that he would never feel any ill will towards anybody, because at that time I had so much ill will towards myself and towards everybody, pretty much. I was very distrustful of people, I was very critical of people, always judging, always being irritating, often getting really angry, and I had a whole backlog of grudges of people that I had resentment towards, you know, that I had felt resentment towards for years. Some for little things, some for very big things, and a whole lot of stuff around my father that like took years to shift. But basically, ill will, anger, rage, resentment were sort of like my constant states of mind. And sometimes quite extreme, actually. It was a very uncomfortable place to live, you know. And I was very kind of reactive. And I think underneath that, later, I discovered there was a lot more vulnerability and fear and grief and things that sometimes the anger was protecting me from, or it was easier to feel the anger. But there was also a lot of anger and ill will that had become almost like a habit. Yeah, I'd thought it was part of my identity, you know, and I thought that was the natural way to be, and I thought, and I very much approached life very much as a victim, feeling aggrieved by people that had done things to me, you know. So for me, Akshobhya was exactly what I needed, because all these Buddhas, they have a special wisdom, and all these Buddhas are supposed to help transform a particular poison. Yeah? So the poison that Akshobhya helps us to transform is the poison of ill will and hatred. And what he does is he transforms that into metta, so kindness and love. Yeah? And what's interesting is that he uses his wisdom to do that, and his wisdom is this mirror-like wisdom. So as I said, I'll be saying more about that next week. But one of the things that really was helpful was beginning to sort of see through my conditioning, see through my views, see all my reactiveness, in a way allowing myself to be honest and own all the bits of myself that were uncomfortable or I didn't want to. And for that, the mirror-like wisdom was just so helpful. You know, just see what is, just see what is, just see what is. Try not to add anything, try not to judge, try not to think, oh, if I'm doing this, if I'm feeling this, I'm a terrible person, which is what I used to do all the time, yeah? And then, because of that, I would never go anywhere near owning it, and therefore there was no chance at all of changing or transforming it. Yeah. So, in a way, he gave me the bit of the courage and the stability to be able to do that, just trying to be more like him. So there's an element where we have all the qualities of the Buddha. We have all that, you know, that you've probably heard that phrase, Buddha nature, or something about Buddha seeds, you know. We have the potential. You know, that's one of the things that's great about Buddhism, is it's saying that we've all got the potential for awakening the heart and the mind, transforming ourselves, becoming, you know, more compassionate, more wise, all these things, and actually becoming like the Buddha. You know, it may take a long time, it takes a lot of work, but if we actually stick with it over time, and, you know, it's, you know, that's what we're trying to do in a way, is we're all aspiring Buddhas, in a way, if we're practicing the Dharma. And what we're doing through practicing ethics, practicing meditation, and, you know, trying to cultivate more insight and wisdom, is in a way making ourselves more like that, awakening more of those qualities, allowing those to shine forth more. And I think if you have been practicing at all, meditation, ethics, something like that, you will have noticed a change, you know, over time. Or if you haven't, your friends and family probably have. And sometimes we don't realise how much we've changed, and then we go back into a situation where we see people we haven't seen for a while, and we realise, actually, yeah, we have changed a lot. Or they tell us we have changed a lot. So there's something about wanting to be more like the Buddha, and there may be certain qualities or certain aspects of the Buddha that appeal to you, or certain teachings that you've heard that particularly resonate, or certain like meditation practices of Pitjatimha time are appropriate to you. So in the same way with these archetypal Buddhas, you know, there may be a time when one particular Buddha speaks to you, you know, and that's because in a way what they embody is something that you really need to cultivate more, or maybe that you find inspiring, or maybe that opens out something different to what you've done before. So, as I said, he's the head of the wisdom family, or the Vajra family. So you might see those... I'm just wondering about whether people should have a go at a Vajra. What do you think? Okay, so we've got a couple of Vajras up there. And in fact, like the Prabhu is going to be doing a whole evening. Ooh, there's lots of Vajras. There's a baby Vajra. And a middle-sized Vajra. And a great big Vajra. I know, I was just thinking. Right, yeah. Great big Vajra. So, diamond thunderbolt, symbol of reality. And you've got the five spokes my friend, which is sort of like, you could see samsara, nirvana, the poisons being transformed into awakening. In fact, there's all kinds of, well, there's loads of symbolism in Vajra, actually. But anyway, it's also very much a symbol of wisdom, enlightenment, and things like the thunderbolt. You know, like how sometimes you can have an insight that is like a thunderbolt. Mm-hmm. You know, cuts through everything, all your views, all your whatever. It can really shake you up. It can really shatter you. But that's one way that we get insight experience. Yeah. So he's associated with that. But he's also associated with wisdom in a much more subtle, gentle way. Because all the Buddhas are associated with the time of the day, and his time of the day is dawn. So if you've ever been up around dawn, it's completely dark, it's a bit mysterious, and then at some point it's become day. You can't actually say at what point it's become day, but suddenly it is day and you can see, and before it was dark. But you can't say, that's when day began, because it is a sort of much more subtle process. And in the same way, there's all kinds of wisdoms, insights that we can get that happen in that kind of way that we're not aware of. We can't pin it down, but at a certain point we've changed, shifted, got more awareness, seen things differently. Yeah. So he embodies all of those. Okay. But anyway...
He's got the Vajra balanced on his hand,
hasn't he? Like he has. So what is quite interesting about the Vajra, so I'm going to take a little Vajra as well to pass around... Do you want to pass that around, Priya? You often see figures wielding a Vajra like a weapon. Yeah. Again, in the symbolism of that Kshobhya, he's not just the head of the wisdom family, he's head of all the wrathful figures. So you may have seen some of those sort of quite scary-looking figures with flames, and they're often dancing, and there's sometimes skulls around and swooping on things. They look a bit demonic. And in a way, they're about the energy that we need to sort of destroy, break through all the things that hold us back, you know, whether it's our conditioning or other things externally, internally. There's that sort of sense of the right of destruction to allow something else to take place. So, interestingly, he's involved with that as well. What you got? Do you want to pass that the other direction? But as Akasha Devi was saying, what's interesting about Akshobhya is that he doesn't wield the Vajra like a weapon. He has it perfectly poised, upright, perfectly balanced. And he's just sitting in meditation posture. There's something very calm, very gentle there. It's said that a Vajra can cut through anything. There's all this power, all this energy, and that it's like a diamond. It's indestructible. Nothing can cut through it. But he sees no need to have it as a weapon. He's just got that there, just gently, all that energy being transformed. And there is something about there is that energy that we can use that is a lot more forceful, but there's also something about gathering energy, transforming energy, and I think particularly within meditation you can really experience that and how transformative that can be as well. So yes, the mirror-like wisdom that just sees what is, wisdom in general, and in a way that thing about transforming hatred is also linked with the wisdom aspect, because it's... well, in Buddhism there's seen as being quite a connection between hatred and wisdom, in that when we hate something, we see it really clearly. You know, all the things we really don't like about it, we see really, really clearly. You know, and if we can see that clearly without the ill will or animosity, without the hatred, you know, that's where we can have insight. That's where we can, you know, when we've not got an agenda, haven't got our own, we get over ourselves in a way, but if we can still see things really, really clearly, that's where there's wisdom and insight. And you may have noticed they're lurking a little bit behind there, but elephants. Some people picked up images of elephants, there were some up there. So all the Buddhas are sort of seated on these lotus thrones, and each of them, their throne is supported by different creatures. So the red Buddha, he's got peacocks, the white Buddha's got lions, Akshobhya has elephants. So elephants, I suppose, like in a jungle, I suppose, like lions and elephants are the sort of most powerful ones there, aren't they? There's something about an elephant. Well, they're so big and they are so powerful, and they could trample you, and they could knock you down, and they can completely destroy. If an elephant is rampaging, it destroys everything its path, knocks down trees, knocks down villages, all that kind of stuff. So again, it kind of that link with the wrathful figures. You know, destroying things, clearing away. But there's also that sense of the elephant as being very gentle and caring. You know, they are very caring within their own communities. They also are quite caring to other creatures. If you sometimes see some of those sort of wildlife things, they will take care of other strays that they come across sometimes. Or if they meet an elephant that's not part of their particular group, that's, you know, not well or whatever. I've seen a bit of footage about a group of elephants helping a drowning rhino, baby rhino. You know, there is something about elephants. And they are, you know, there is something about elephants where they're kind of collective, a bit like the Sangha. They do have a lot of memory and wisdom and all that kind of stuff, I think. So, again, I think that it's quite interesting that he's connected with the elephant. And that, yes, so I think there's something really also about water. So apart from the depths and the darkness of the depths and the stillness, you know, like however busy the water is at the surface, there might be a storm going on. If you're on at sea, you know, deep down, deep down, deep down, it's really deep and really still and unfathomable. And there's all these things contained in there that you don't know about, aren't there, deep down below. And it's a bit like that with us. There's all these things deep down below we might not be so conscious or aware of, but there is a stillness there that we can access sometimes. There is a depth there. There is some creative figure that we can open to, be more receptive to. Something about just being open to our potential, just listening to a deeper truth that we often don't listen to. Sometimes we think that's the right thing to do, or been told that's the right thing to do, so we do it, and there's a part of us that knows that actually that's not the right thing to do, or, you know. So it's learning to listen to sort of that deeper wisdom within as well, to trust ourselves, to trust our knowledge. At the same time, as not necessarily mistaking that with preferences, because sometimes we can think it's an intuition, it's just that we don't want to do something, you know, or we do want to do something, we're just justifying it. Yeah. But I suppose that's where that sort of wisdom and listening and seeing things clearly all plays in with each other. So, for me, At different times, I get kind of fascinated or very engaged with a different aspect of the symbolism around Akshobhya. Sometimes it's the water. Sometimes it's the Vajra. Sometimes it's the elephants. Sometimes it's dawn. Or sometimes it's the colour. Sometimes it's just his name. The fact of the unshakableness. And I don't necessarily have to start thinking, oh, I'm interested in this, da-da-da. Just allowing the image to be there and reverberate in my psyche or something will quite often open out something. And he has become very real to me, very much a presence in my life. Well, some of these other figures have too, but Akshobhya has been like a steady presence probably for 20 years now. My first love was Amitabha, the Red Buddha of the West, who I still deeply love, and it's quite interesting that they embody the wisdom and compassion aspects and they balance each other out, and for years they were like very much my go-to Buddhas. And, you know, with these figures you think, are they real, are they not real, are they inner, are they outer? Is it just sort of an archetype? You can justify and rationalise it, but there's another level where, by surrendering that whole process and not worrying about whether they're real or not real or whatever, you can just respond. You can just get into relationship with them. They can just become a real presence in your life and a real support and guide. You know, so like if I'm going through a hard time, in a way I kind of call upon like Sherby or know he's there. You know, I find that helpful. Other people may not find that helpful. I've stopped worrying about whether or not, you know, it's rational or not. You know, initially I did worry about that, and now I don't at all. And if I have a vision of Akshobhya in any kind of context, I listen to it and I think, well, it could be my unconscious or my psyche, but it could actually be that Akshobhya's out there, you know. And yeah, it's interesting. A while ago, I was exploring the idea of it was Bowlby and attachments and the idea of a secure base. And I don't know if any of you are aware of him, but anyway, he was a psychoanalyst and one of the people who did a lot of work around the impact and effect of separation of babies and infants from their parents in hospital, because in those days that used to happen. If a baby was ill or not, they would keep them away from the parents and not let people visit or stay overnight, often for long periods. And also the effect of evacuation during the war on children. And so he did a lot about the effect, the positive and negative effects of having a sort of secure emotional bond with at least one significant adult. And the quality of that connection, you know, would have a big impact on, I suppose, in the way that people internalise the possibilities of relationships and how related to themselves and other people in the world after that. Yeah. And I know for myself, I would very insecure attachments, in a way, and a lot of absence and a lot of separation when I was a baby. And what's been interesting to me is, in a way, it's like the Buddhas and people like Akshobhya have become my secure attachments, you know. There's an idea in Buddhism sometimes about true and false refuges, you know, that there are certain things that we go to make ourselves feel better, to help us deal with the things that we find really difficult in the world, and the suffering, and our fear of death, and all those kinds of things. And, you know, and quite often we go for things that actually will just give us temporary respite, you know. So maybe we think having a bar of chocolate, or, you know, having the right relationship, having the right job, having the right house, having, you know, we could go for external things that we think, or the perfect career, or, you know. And even if we do get a really positive relationship, a great job and all those kinds of things, it's only temporary, because they will change, they will end at a certain point. So you can't totally rely on them, and in a way it's relying on something external to sort of make something happen. But then the idea of true refuges are things like the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, the sense that those are things that in a way have a more ultimate reality and truth, and that that never changes, so those are much more of a true refuge. At least that's kind of a bit of my take on that. Other people may disagree. So, if you're new to these figures, I just invite you to just be open and see what happens, really. I think receptivity is a key in all of our practice. If you're meditating, just seeing what's emerging all the time. So I'm not necessarily expecting everybody else to form a connection with Akshobhya or fall in love with Akshobhya, but I think, you know, you can look at the images, you can let the images have an effect on you, you can let water have an effect on you, you can let mirrors have an effect on you, you can let elephants have an effect on you, the colour blue, and maybe as you find out a little bit more over the course of the next session about what all the different elements of the symbolism are, it might speak to you more, or it may not. But we will also be doing a little bit of ritual and chanting and things at time to time, and reflection. And I am going to end this little bit with reading an invocation to Akshobhya, and then we're going to chant his mantra. So mantras, as I said, they're sort of sound syllables, and they can be like an embodiment of a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva, or their particular qualities they represent. They're also a way of us opening ourselves to them, or maybe trying to make a connection with them. So if you're chanting the Akshobhya mantra, yes, you're trying to connect with, or maybe come into a relationship with Akshobhya, but they're also very much about the quality of wisdom. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read an invocation, which is sort of like poetic kind of invocation to Akshobhya, and I'm just inviting you to just be receptive, just be open, let the words come and go, just like a poem, you don't have to understand it, but notice if any of it resonates on any kind of level with you. Yeah? And then I'll start the chant, and we're going to do it as a plain chant, not as a melody, but just on one note, we're just going to keep on repeating that chant, and when that fades away, we'll have a little bit of quiet sitting. Invocation of Akshobhya. Turning to the east, in the time before dawn, I bow to the deep blue light that is the Buddha Akshobhya. Master of the depths, you sit on a pale blue lotus, touching the earth with the fingers of your right hand. Balanced in your left hand, perfectly upright, is the golden Vajra. You sit deep in meditation, your lips glowing red, your eyes drawn inward. Around you a nimbus of red light and a wisdom aura of green surrounds your head. You are the guardian of my depths. Your knowledge is deeper than a thousand oceans. You are universe unto yourself. In your heart, on a pale blue lotus, is the mystic seed syllable, Hum. All deeds, all the past, all depth is contained within you. You are immutable, unshakable. You cannot be fathomed. However deep I am, you are always deeper. There is a universe within your heart. You are the potential of the yet-to-be-born day, of the time before dawn, of light gathering below the horizon, waiting to emerge. You are gathering energy within you, like acorns waiting to grow, taking root. You are the water element that nourishes life. You are the wisdom of the great mirror, reflecting back all things, clearly and undistorted. You are the truth, the strange, mysterious truth of the depths, a truth which slowly grows within us, like the gradual dawning of a new day. There is a universe within your heart. Stepping into it, hands folded to my heart, I enter the eastern pure land of Abirati, the realm of complete joy. In this land protected by you, no vows can be broken, no depths distorted, no falsehood spoken. It is a land of harmony with ourselves, of true and deep contact with what we really are. Once connected like this, we reside in a deep sense of well-being, of living in harmony with reality, where we are rooted and unshakable, where we become fulfilled and whole. O Vajrakshobhya, help us to overcome our anger, to overcome irritation that arises from small concerns. Help us to rid ourselves of the poison of hatred that goes against our deepest wishes. O Vajrakshobhya, hold up the mirror of your supreme wisdom so that we may clearly see what needs to be done. Om Vajrakshobhya Om. Om Vajrakshobhya Om.
Om Vajrakshobhya Om. Om Vajrakshobhya Om. Om Vajrakshobhya Om.